Okay, we're back for another episode of Powers and Principalities. I think it's episode 112. So, Joe, how are you doing?
I'm just fine, Jim. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Well, tonight we agreed to talk about politics and organized crime, or organized crime and politics, which is a junior partner. Of course, with organized crime, we kind of know what that is. It's just a category of sort of transnational, national, or local groupings of highly, I guess, well organized isn't the name, but kind of a highly centralized enterprise run by criminals who tend to engage in illegal activity, usually relatively high level illegal activity for profit. Criminal organizations such as terrorist groups are politically motivated, but organized crime tends to suggest groups that sort of cartelize or take over certain industries, often vices or things on the margins of society. Prostitution, gambling, and then moving into banking and politics. What happens when they become highly organized? They become highly disciplined and sophisticated. I guess we can consider them organized. When we think of organized crime, we think of the five families. This would be the Bonanno, Colombo, Gambino, Genovese, Lucchese families of New York. We think of Al Capone, Dutch Schultz, Meyer Lansky, Lucky Luciano, Johnny Roselli, these characters, Sam Giancana. We think of movies like The Godfather, Goodfellas, directors Martin Scorsese and Francis Ford Coppola making these movies. And much of our ideas of gangsters is like the world itself is seen through the lens of Hollywood. But one thing, interesting aspect of organized crime is the fact that, well, a lot of people think there's a divide line between organized crime and the government, the state, and politics. You know, one being there for law and order, the other being there to commit crimes and work underground, the underworld, so to speak. But as you really examine the history of organized crime, it has tended to develop and work its way into, insinuate itself, and become a partner with many political figures, political families, and corporations. Obviously, we think of Las Vegas, and of course, Hollywood. The mob is there too. For example, is the Kennedy family. Of course, Joe Kennedy, the patriarch of that family. He was a bootlegger who worked with a lot of gangsters in the 20s and 30s and sort of went legit and then sort of leveraged the money that he earned in illegal bootlegging to get into politics and even filmmaking. We think of the 1960 election. We could talk about that, how the Chicago outfit secured the election of John F. Kennedy. Another example would be Roy Cohn, an interesting figure who had his feet in both worlds, both the world of politics and also the underworld, and of course his ties to the current president, Donald Trump. So there's a lot to talk about here. The use of organized crime by intelligence agencies in various wars, and also in carrying out sort of assassination campaigns. We think of Operation Mongoose and how the mob was brought in with Johnny Roselli to attempt to dethrone Castro in Cuba. It's a very murky world. It's also the lines between politics and organized crime are certainly blurred because it's hard to distinguish the two enterprises, really. So that's organized crime. We can get into some of the particular examples and the history of this, and what does it really say about our society and the American system?
Right. What does it say? Well, before the show, I had given you like my little witticism was the result of looking at basically, how organized crime and government, functioned and were related inside the United States and elsewhere. And I said that I started out trying to determine, what component of government was actually organized crime, and I found out that actually it was the reverse, that really organized crime was the overarching structure. Government was really an aspect of it. And oddly enough, Tim, even though I would spend my whole time, like I was reading stuff about, you know, like, and we'll get into, like, I want to get into like things like the Kennedy assassination, for example, which I think is an example of how organized crime at a high level functions. But the example that I found was really, that was the most illustrative and the one that I would recommend the, you know, insomniac listener who wants to get really into what the structure of the of organized crime is to study P2, the P2 scandal, Propaganda Due. This was the famous, you know, 1980s scandal that broke out in Italy. And the reason why it's so important is because so many documents just happened to be found and brought into the public so that you could kind of see the relationships between the different components. And it's just laid out beautifully. I mean, you can see that somehow Freemasonry is basically has a central role, because it's, I mean, just as an example, so Roberto Calvi, who was known as God's banker because of his ties into the Vatican, he was found in London. He'd been killed in London, and the symbolism was clear. He was on Blackfriars Bridge. Blackfriar is a, you know, a Masonic name, and in fact, actually has been associated as one of the, or the Italian version of the word, as a name for P2, Blackfriar. So this was clearly, you know, like the symbolism was being presented to the public, which I think is another thing that we have happened to us quite a bit. And it's a way that, you know, if we understand the symbols, we can see into, you know, basically who's involved here. And in the case of P2, I mean, it's just everyone, basically. You know, my attempt at wit, you know, with the idea that government is an aspect of organized crime, it really is the case, and you can see it in P2, because the Vatican is somehow involved. Obviously, Freemasonry is involved. The intelligence services of the nation of Italy were involved, because the heads of the intelligence services appeared as on a list of prominent members of the P2 Freemason Lodge. And so it's just, there isn't any part of what we see as government that isn't involved. And even you know, more illustrative of what the situation we face in the United States is that P2 had purchased one of the largest newspapers in Italy, just for the purpose of basically, you know, making you know, their activities easier to, you know, hoist on the public. The plan that P2 was evidently, you know, looking at was a complete overt takeover of the government. They were going to use some kind of problem with communism as the basis for it. But, you know, when you think about the fact that, you know, that future prime ministers like Berlusconi would appear on their list of members, it actually looks like they succeeded to a very large extent.
Yeah, he was a media mogul, right?
Yeah, he was at the time. And then, but you see, what my point is that this should have been, if there was, like, you know, a functioning media or what, some kind of watchdog organization, he would never have been permitted to enter into politics, let alone become prime minister of Italy, you see. So it's just, now, you know, the details are disputed of the thing. I mean, it's known that Berlusconi was, you know, on the list. You have people like, General Vito Micheli, you know, he was the head of the Army's intelligence service. There were, you know, Department of the Interior ministers, you know, the military, the general who was sent to Vito, he was the head of the military intelligence service. The admiral, who was the chief of the general staff of the Army, I mean, it just goes on and on. And so basically what it exposed was the fact that the government was fake, right? It, so that the criminal activity, which, you know, the public sees as the P2 Blackfriar bridge scandal, which is kind of washing into the Vatican. There's money laundering, different things. I mean, this is just the tiniest aspect. You know, it's the entire, and so what it shows is, to me, is that you have the secret society, and so criminality is everywhere. It's all criminal. The whole nature of government is basically criminal in the sense that it's illegitimate, and that it will murder and steal whenever it whenever it wants to. The manipulation to maneuver, you know, the people into activity is important to bear in mind, because a lot of the criminality, like stuff we've talked about, like crack cocaine, they don't actually go out on the street and sell it, but they maneuver, you know, freeway Ricky Ross into position and then protect him and then guide him and then, you know, basically move pawns like this into position so that they can affect the crime that they're trying to achieve. Most of the crimes are basically cultural destruction, you know, which is a clear criminal act. And when you look at, just to kind of circle back to P2, I mean, this is obviously one group that I didn't mention was the mafia, which of course is completely involved in this thing. And of course the members between the mafia and P2 Masonic Lodge just go back and forth.
Revival of the mafia in Italy was a product of the Allied campaign against Mussolini's regime, who had cracked down on the mafia in Italy. And it was revived, and of course weaponized, utilized to go against communists in the elections in, you know, right, in the late 40s.
Go against communists. And so here, you know, you have, like, I'll just, as an example, we talked about, Stonewall Rebellion, you know, which begins the introduction of gay culture, you know, as a separate civil rights movement in America. And then we notice that it's owned by the mafia.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, this is very telling, because here in the other, in the P2, you can also see that the mafia is involved. And I wanted just to mention something that was pointed out to me after the show, which I think is kind of amusing. And it's actually pretty significant and helps sort of understand, like, this fleshing out of the whole span of interrelationships, is that, you know, I mentioned that Harry Hayes, you know, his organization that brings about the media and the proto protest and all the stuff that leads up to the media circus, with the Stonewall so-called riots were brought about. But his organization was called Mattachine, which is the name of this Masonic organization in the Middle Ages, which is basically kind of it presents itself as like pranksters. You know, they're a secret society. They take oaths. They're involved in cultural destruction, basically. And so that's why, you know, when you see the Merry Pranksters in the 60s and Mattachine, you know, have both using names that the organization had at different times, it's very telling, you know, that they're relating back to this. But there are a couple other names for these people. One is Puck, you know, Shakespeare uses this, but the other name is Robin Goodfellow. And someone pointed out to me, he goes, you know, it's interesting because Scorsese's film was called Goodfellas.
Yeah.
and no one really quite understood, because he was saying that in the movie, it says, well, you know, we just call each other Goodfellas. Well, that's not true. This something was Scorsese was called on. They were going, wait a second, where are the mafia guys that call themselves Goodfellas? But you see, when you think of it in this light, that the mafia has as its primary function basically cultural destruction, right? In other words, it's not just to steal money. Of course, it's doing this, but it is protected and will sometimes be used by the larger political forces to just for the pure purpose of social destruction. And so supposedly, again, this is something I can't prove, though I've heard plenty of rumors about it, that the original Bloods and Crips in Los Angeles were pushed into existence by mafia individuals, that there were organized, so-called organized crime guys that were trying to help them, you know, onto their way. And it was certainly the case with, you know, this other culturally destructive force, you know, that was let loose from the Stonewall Bar that was owned by the mafia. So, you know, I just, to me, the hard thing is to, you know, get clear data, you know, as to when it is that, you know, organizations like the mafia are working on behest of the secret society and the government.
Yeah, that would explain the prominent Jewish role in organized crime and why it tends to be understated in the popular treatment of organized crime. I mean, you mentioned, you know, Francis Ford Coppola and Martin Scorsese, and their job is pretty much to pin organized crime on Italians. Because whenever you see their movies, Jewish figures play a sort of a ancillary or supportive role, as opposed to primary actors like a Meyer Lansky or a Mo Dalitz, you know.
Very strange, isn't it? Yeah. Very strange, and it certainly requires an explanation. It's the whole crypto nature. I mean, because you look at the mafia and you go, well, they're Sicilians. Well, are they? So what does that mean, a Sicilian? It's sort of like the Young Turks. Mm-hmm. You know, in that phenomena where you have them described as Turks, the Young Turks, well, they may have come from Turkey, but they don't turn out to be Turks. You know, when you do an analysis of the organization, you see Jews and Masons.
Yes. Yeah.
And so, you know, you have to, I mean, I hate to say it because it leads us to our often, held position that we really got to get to the bottom of the racial struggle. And I think that, frankly, if you look at what's presented to the public, you know, as the government, but then you see all these organized crime elements coming in. Man, this is the first thing you've got to try to find out is that, well, you know, exactly what are the ethnic structures to the whole thing? And you can't just, you know, take their word as, you know, like I'm an Anglican or something, you know. I mean, there is a strong possibility, in my, you know, opinion, that there is some animating force, you know, and certainly the idea that, that they could be seeing themselves as an ethnicity or even as a religious, because who knows, you know, how it's structured at the top. But in any case, that's what you have to try to tease out, because, I mean, it isn't like if you look at Gary Webb's stuff where he says, look, you know, the CIA is assisting the bringing in of cocaine. And then you have the cocaine sales. Right. Well, in this sense, the government is not guilty of the sales on the street, but they are guilty of basically maneuvering the whole structure into place so that the crime will take place.
Yeah, they can cartelize the system by cracking down on one organization or cartel or family at a time. That's seems to be what occurred whenever there was a crackdown, you know, whether it was Bobby Kennedy's crusade or the Kefauver hearings or even Operation Underworld, sort of the way the operations were taken over by higher interests and organized and cartelized. For the purpose of the discussion tonight, let's maybe perhaps give a few examples of the sort of this commingling or mixture of organized crime and politics, and a couple of examples. One that I think we talked about this when we did the show on John McCain. And John McCain, of course, married into a very wealthy family that his father-in-law had the beer monopoly in Phoenix. And, of course, he was able to get that monopoly while working with a lieutenant or a of the Brofman Lansky network. I think it was Mo Kemper. What was his name? Kemper Marley. Marley. And so he married in this wealthy family that was tied directly to the Brofmans and Lansky. And off went his political career. Another, of course, a famous example, infamous perhaps, is Harry Truman, you know, and the Pendergast machine and the Kansas City outfit, the Kansas City mob. Al, Truman was literally a bag man for the Pendergast machine. Pendergast himself was a Catholic, I believe. But he worked again with that Kansas City syndicate that was linked to Chicago. But he was basically appointed judge, then became senator, and became, of course, vice president in 1944, and then eventually president when FDR died in April 1945. So those are just two examples. Of course, we mentioned the Kennedy family, and of course, the Kennedys are an interesting example because apparently the mafia, at least the Chicago syndicate, was used to help John Kennedy's political rise, at least to the presidency, national prominence when he won the presidency in 1960. And at the same time, the other side is also utilizing the mob to some alleged to kill the pre kill John F. Kennedy. This may be relating to Cuba and Operation Mongoose, where the CIA was working with the mob to get Castro, supposedly. So that's a good example of that. Of course, we have another example, Operation Underworld. This was the operation that freed Charles Lucky Luciano from prison. He'd been in prison since the late 30s. He went up river on I think for prostitution charges. He ran New York City's 200 brothels, and apparently he beat up one too many women, and they finally testified against him. And he was sort of made a target by, I think, by Thomas Dewey. And some people suggest that this is a way for Meyer Lansky to get control of the situation. But nevertheless, this plan was hatched because supposedly the War Department was worried about sabotage on the New York ports. They blamed it on the Germans, but I think it's the ship to Normandy that was being prepared for the war, and it burned. And some people think that was a message the mob sent to the War Department to say that this is our territory. And so they got Luciano there to sort of get control of the ports, to sort of make a deal with the mob and for the purposes of the war effort. And the deal that Luciano would be freed from prison, and he'd be exiled back to Italy. And the deal was Luciano, this isn't official, but what happened was Luciano then sort of got the monopoly on heroin coming out of Italy, then Turkey, and this eventually became I think the transshipment point eventually became Marseille. This became the infamous French Connection. And of course, this time, it was in the aftermath of Operation Underworld that the heroin addiction skyrocketed in the United States because of the shipments that were coming in because of this operation. In this deal, Thomas Dewey, I think, at some point was given $2 million by Alan Dulles to be a chief investor in the Mary Carter Paint Company. The Mary Carter Paint Company was established to launder profits from the heroin trade, Meyer Lansky's heroin trade, I think coming through Mexico at the time. But the Mary Carter Paint Company again would eventually become Resorts International, develop Paradise Island in the Bahamas, and also establish casinos in Atlantic City. It was owned by Donald Trump for a little while, then sold to Merv Griffin. But so this is how connected this is, and this also involves Rory Cohn, the CIA, Paul Helliwell, the Castle Bank. All these banks that are CIA connected are being used to launder money. So this is just an example of just how integrated politics, banking, finance, entertainment, and we can talk about Las Vegas and Hollywood, of course. How Hollywood itself, California in the post-war era, you're part of the woods. The population doubled between 1940 and 1960, and so there's a lot of opportunity there. Land was cheap. But happened during the war, FDR signed that executive order, and the Supreme Court endorsed it, gave it its seal of approval by putting Japanese on the West Coast in internment camps. And there's a whole lot of, they owned a lot of property, and then the government seized the property. After the war, it had to be sold off. Of course, it wasn't given back to the Japanese Americans, but it was sold off to pretty much friends of the syndicate. And this was orchestrated by this guy, David Baselin, who was sort of given the position, an important position from the federal government, to sell off property. And he immediately sold it off to his buddies in the syndicate. And one was like Henry Crown. And Henry Crown would get like properties that for pennies on the dollar. He bought vast stretches of real estate, some very valuable mines and these things. This became the basis of his huge fortune. And then he would invest heavily in not Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics. And this factored in Kennedy, because during the Kennedy administration, there was a scandal with a procurement contract for the, I think it was the F-111 plane, which was the F-35 of its day. It was a disaster. And it was $300 million loss or something for General Dynamics, and they were, you know, in trouble. And so what happened was John F. Kennedy gave the contract for this plane. In fact, it wasn't the F-1, it was some other plane that it had messed up on. So this is another lucrative contract. And they were, it probably should have been given to Boeing or Lockheed Martin, it was given to General Dynamics as a payoff to the Crown family. Because the Crown family, this mob-connected family, had $300 million invested in General Dynamics. And it was some of a ministerial scandal at the time, but this was the deep politics. And what happened was basically they had gotten the goods on Kennedy, apparently was, again, doing his thing, sleeping aroundly. Some people think he was blackmailed into giving the contract to General Dynamics. But much of the power structure in California, Lou Wasserman and these characters, these are guys, Sidney Korshak, these are guys that had come in from the Chicago outfit and then kind of made good in California, made a lot of money, got into entertainment, started Music Corporation of America, got into Hollywood. Of course, Lou Wasserman was the backer of Ronald Reagan. And Ronald Reagan was a washed-up B-movie actor who then was given a lucrative TV career because president of the Film Screen Actors Guild, he gave him a waiver for MCA to get involved in also, just basically owning TV stations and production, some sort of waiver that helped Lou Wasserman build his media empire, became a Hollywood mogul. And another character, Paul Ziffrin, who was instrumental in building up the Democratic Party in California. And of course, he was connected to Bazelon and these guys. And he, I think, built the career of Pat Brown, a name you're probably familiar with.
Yeah. And then that links right into, the Getty family, mm-hmm. Gavin Newsom, and the whole cesspool that's is California politics now. The getting back to the P2 scandal, one of the basic problems the public has in understanding the relationship that we're trying to lay out is that it involves a conspiracy. By definition, it's mm-hmm. always a conspiracy. There's no way that government and organized crime can link other than by hit conspiracy and a hidden conspiracy. And so, you mentioned things like, Alan Dulles arranged for the money that Truman used to start up the chain of investments that ends up with Resort International, right?
Or Thomas Dewey, rather.
Excuse me, Thomas Dewey. But Dulles was involved in that somehow. I'm trying to think. Anyway, Dulles is the family is very difficult to investigate because of their relationships that are political, mm-hmm. right? And in Italy, incredibly, it never really got anywhere because they were able just to ride out the storm and they would come up with alternative ideas, even though they're kind of nonsensical. And eventually the public lost interest. Mm-hmm. And here in the United States, where you're starting to see a lot of people question basically what are criminal acts and, for example, 911. But it's always the case that the government can stand on the ground of you're being hysterical. This is a conspiracy theory. And it's important, of course, to remember that conspiracy theory as a concept was developed by the government to keep us from thinking clearly, mm-hmm. right? It traces back to the famous memo, which is related to the Kennedy assassination of all things, right? I don't know if you've ever read the memo, but it's just a classic kind of logical pretzel showing how hard it is for the public to actually think clearly about the government and organized crime being basically, related to one another. In the memo, it said that, it talked about the Warren Commission and, because the memo was about the Kennedy assassination and it pointed out that a lot of people are starting to doubt the Warren Commission and it was giving ammunition for people to head off these people who are coming up with that idea. And it invented the phrase, you know, conspiracy theorist and conspiracy theory. And it was going to give ways that those phrases could be used to basically browbeat people. And it started out by saying, you know, the members of the Warren Commission were chosen for their integrity, experience, and prominence. They represented both major parties, and they and their staff were deliberately drawn from all sections of the country. So in other words, this is self-criticism, right? It's saying that, look, the Warren Commission is because they're on both sides of the party, and they're notable, they're prominent. Why in the world would we ever, you know, not take their word, because they came up with the conclusion that it was the lone gunman? But, you know, that's why when I was talking to someone the other day who's actually a very knowledgeable individual in terms of history, he had no idea who was actually on the commission. And so I thought it'd be kind of useful to point this out, because this actually explains why the relationship between crime, the killing of President Kennedy, and the government, you know, it can't be seen, because they control the process by which, you know, the judgment is vetted. And, you know, you just have to look at the members. You have Earl Warren, who was the California's Grand Master of Freemasonry before he became, I forget what he started out, you know, he was some low-level political thing, but then he ends up...
His political rise was backed by a underworld-tied lawyer, too. Chotiner, I think, was his name, yeah.
That's right. A mob attorney was helping Earl, who had been the Grand Master of California Freemasonry. You've got Richard Russell, right? He was a senator from Georgia. He was a family member of the Russell family who had created Skull and Bones, right? Then you had John Sherman Cooper. He's from Kentucky. Well, wait a second. He was a Skull and Bones member. You have Gerald Ford, who's another high-level Freemason. You had John McCloy, yeah, who was the founder of the OSS, a CFR member, and the president of the World Bank, just your regular run-of-the-mill, you know, guys both sides of the political spectrum. You had Alan Spector, right, the Jewish attorney, and a very prominent Freemason, right? And then, of course, you also had, of all things, Alan Dulles rounding it out. He was the current director of the Central Intelligence Agency.
Was that Arlen Specter?
Arlen Specter, I'm sorry, yeah.
Okay, yeah, sorry. It didn't sound, yeah, sorry.
So Arlen Specter and Alan Welch Dulles, I mean...
Yeah, Arlen came up with that bullet theory, right?
The magic bullet theory belonged to him, which...
Then his career took off.
So it's just so preposterous. But anyway, you know, this is what... When you have this collection of individuals, it can't be obviously organized circumstantially, right? This is these are controllable elements that are within the secret societies. You know, you've got too many Skull and Bones members, Masons, directors of Central Intelligence, one of the founders of the OSS, president of the World Bank. I mean, it's just so when you, and then of course Earl Warren heading it up. Well, look, the relationship between organized crime and government is a conspiracy. And if they are going to also control the vetting of, you know, when people bring forward the idea that the government may have could be involved in criminal activity, and they get some things like the Warren Commission, and the public doesn't attack that as a second crime, then you're not going to get very far, are you?
Yeah. So, and good example of that, if you're saying this is a, you know, what evidence of this? Operation Mongoose. Right, this plan to assassinate Castro, which is sort of a umbrella program, and this involved the mobilization or use of mafioso figures, particularly hitmen or so-called mechanics, and the lead person on this in terms of the mob would have been Johnny Roselli, who was out in California and in Las Vegas, and he probably got in over his head on this one because he ended up being cut up in little pieces and floating in Miami Harbor in 1976.
Yeah,
just when the House of Representatives was investigating subcommittee on assassinations, was reinvestigating the Kennedy assassination, and whose final conclusion in 1979 was it was most likely a conspiracy, which people don't talk about. The last official word, at least on the part of the federal government, on the JFK assassination is that it was most likely a conspiracy. So,
yeah. And you can see the pattern just repeats itself over and over again. When I was in Havana, I was talking to people there about, you know, Batista, the the prime minister that Fidel overthrew. They were saying that, yeah, well, the public was very upset about really the cultural degradation that was going on, and they specifically brought up the idea that the American mafiosa guys, Meyer Lansky and Bugsy Siegel, had come to Havana and worked out a deal with him of basically a union between government and organized crime. And this would have been running prostitution, but of course, drugs and gambling would have been part of it as well. And so that's the model, right? That's you know, that extends back to the United States, goes everywhere. It's in Italy. It's everywhere. It's everywhere. It's just our government, unfortunately, has been overwhelmed by Goodfellas.
Yeah, and the move out to Las Vegas was after they've been kicked out of Newport, Kentucky. You know what happened was the so-called Jewish Navy. There was this smuggling operation in Lake Erie in Ohio, and this was Mo Dalitz and Meyer Lansky, and they established in Newport, Kentucky, sort of an island of vice, prostitution, brothels, and gambling. And I believe in the 1940s, there were local elections where these guys were chased out, and they went off to Las Vegas, and which had legalized gambling, I think, in 1931. And it was, I guess it was the, you know, it was Lansky and Dalitz, although some people say Bugsy Siegel, that's sort of exaggerated. But anyway, they were instrumental in building up Las Vegas. Yeah. And this was, of course, Las Vegas became increasingly important because they needed a way to launder the money they were making off drugs, particularly heroin. But also when gambling became a big thing, too, it became just another way to sort of fleece and exploit the weaknesses of the Goyim.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, because it's so hard to determine where you have just legitimate criminals and then where you have basically either government operatives or people who are being maneuvered from above.
Yeah.
Right? The lines always are blurring.
It's like, why would the CIA help with the development of Disneyland or Disney World?
Right. Why would the CIA help with the production of the acid test with Ken Keith? You know, it's like you have to think deeply about what they intend to do with culture.
Well, that gets into Bateman, right? Bateson, right? Weaponized anthropology, you know.
Of course. Yeah. But that's the thing is that you see criminality and organized criminality changed at that point. Once they had enough sort of what they felt was psychological and cultural science that they could start to basically get what they wanted, a slave state. Mm-hmm. Then criminality changed. And then, you know, I think...
Well, once they got into media, I mean, the movies are always controlled, but they got into media and broadcasting, which I mentioned now with American Music Corporation and the Music Corporation of America, rather. But they could also control the narrative. This is a good example. As early as 1908, there was a guy named Theodore Bingman in New York. He was the New York Police Commissioner, New York City. And he wrote a report or a study on crime, criminal behavior, broken down by ethnicity in New York, and he found out that Jews had a crime rate that was three times higher than the general population, and much higher than even the Italians, who were considered a problem group in terms of crime. And the study itself was rather balanced, but nevertheless, even as early as 1908, Jewish pressure forced him out of the job, and he was forced to apologize for making this observation. So early on, it became, while you could pin crimes on Italians or Sicilians or other groups, blacks, if you talked about high rates of crime among Jews, you were labeled anti-Semite, and that wouldn't be tolerated.
That's interesting. I was unaware of that, and that's interesting because of the timing. I mean, this is before, you know, the Holocaust and that narrative, you know, how that was being...
Remember, 1880s was a big time. That's when Jews started to leave Russia, the peril of the settlement, in the wake of the assassination of the Tsar. And they came Andrew Joyce has done good work on this, is how the excuse for the Jews leaving Russia and Poland, that area, they claim oppression, they claim the pogroms. Well, now it turns out a lot of these claims, surprise, surprise, were wildly exaggerated. So they came to America with stories of, you know, self-serving, you know, lachrymose stories of oppression and pogroms, and, you know, of, facing. So they came up to America, and America is sort of an open system. And when you have a system that's very open, and the political system, and you have a sort of a group of people that are willing to, you know, engage in all types of crime and justify their lack of ethics or criminal behavior, they're going to do well, you know.
Well, sure. And, of course, remember, there is always this strange relationship between Freemasonry and Jews. Mm-hmm. They're just so many times you find them hand in hand, and it's such a powerful combination. I mean, of course, look at, you know, in the United States, the number of presidents that have been Masons.
Yes.
You know, and so then that filters down. And so if these people have that same, just as a matter of system, have that kind of perspective that they're there really to promote Jewish interests, right? Mm-hmm. Then you can't even contest it as like a racial attack, because you don't see, like Woodrow Wilson.
Or Jagger Hoover or something.
Jagger Hoover, you say, well, these people aren't Jews, but they may be Masons, and they may be creating central banks or, you know, laws which makes no sense in terms of the general European population. But, you don't really have the ability to basically talk about the ethnic perspective of the process, right? Mm-hmm. It's just the grammar's not there, because you've got Woodrow Wilson. And I mean, even though you try to analyze his behavior as like a European, you go, well, what is he doing? Mm-hmm. It doesn't make any sense. It makes perfect sense if you look at him as part of an ethnic warfare that's being run by cryptos. Make perfect sense.
And you have blackmail too.
Well, of course. That's always
Jagger Hoover always apparently everybody. Was blackmailed by Lansky and Woodrow Wilson. Was
and that, and that goes to the idea of the point where you have cultural criminality and also street criminality. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like Freeway Ricky Ross. I mean, that street criminality, the people directly above him are just, you know, involved in cultural criminality. Freeway Ross is going to end up in prison, and the people above him managing him are, you know, State Department heroes. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to know where you have the, you know, people operating in just kind of the venal criminal perspective, and when they're being managed from above. But in general, I just think it goes back to the idea of, you know, you've got to it's going to be this one is like, the more I looked at this, Tim, I go, good heavens, this is such a bag of spaghetti. It's almost impossible to get your hands through all this stuff. You know what I mean? It's just because it's everywhere. It's like that little stream of events that you talked about, where you end up with a Resorts International being created. You know, you have criminality at some perspective, out and out crimes. You've got murder, obviously. But then on the other side, you have political actions, political influence, media. So it's, you have to just look with an open mind at the whole process and just try to understand how it worked in a general sense. And that's why, like, you know, we have the expression building out the schematic. That is just critical, because then you can like place the long-term program, and when you start to plug in the details, the individuals who seem to be involved with it, you can try to break out, you know, the real power of the thing, right? Which I think you're going to see is, in the level of the secret society. It isn't going to be in the street criminals. They're not really, organizing things which damage culture. They're just trying to steal and create individual power for themselves.
Yeah, if you look at something like a place like California, the entire power structure in California that we see today was a product of theft and networking.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't that these people were necessarily smarter or more, you know, industrious and or luckier, they took stolen property, gave it to their friends, and built upon that, and they used that money to elect representatives, whether it's Nixon or Reagan or the Brown family, and they controlled the political process because a place, especially a place like California, where it's such a huge state that money matters so much in political elections. So they could just buy everything, buy ads and these things. And, you know, people could run in any party. You could run as a Republican or a Democrat at the same time and actually win office. So that's the way it was in California in the mid-20th century. But the point being made here again is that it's not as if the power structure has accountability. It's been elected democratically. It's all theft, graft, and networking. You know, which is perfectly for Masonry, which is perfect, you know, for like a Masonic operation, because that's what it's there for primarily. A good example of a figure, you know, if you look at a figure like Roy Cohn and his career, and how do you, you know, Roy Cohn lived to be what, 60, I guess 59, supposedly died of AIDS. He was a, you know, the a degenerate homosexual. Repeat myself. But anyway, he was this, you know, big. Look at his career. I mean, he worked with Bobby Kennedy, worked with McCarthy. He was a lobbyist. And someone said, you know, someone said, if Roy Cohn is such a horrible person, why do you have so many powerful friends?
Yeah, and he was instrumental in the Trump family real estate empire.
Yeah. But yeah, he was good friends with J. Edgar Hoover, and also at the same time, this guy Lowensteel, another Jewish gangster, and Louis Rosenstiel, and he also had tie. He also had good friends with the media. It's another example: Cy Newhouse, and also I think Rosenthal of the New York Times, and he also did. Had connections with the guy Walter Winchell, I think. So it spread rumors about people and, you know, these things. So the media is sort of locked down, controlled for these interests. And I guess he was eventually prosecuted. Was it Morgenthau who prosecuted him? I guess.
Yes, I think he did. Yeah.
Yeah. And, but again, it's one of these things. And it was Detective James Rothstein who talked to Roy Cohn, and Roy Cohn, during the sit-down, admitted to Rothstein he was part of a rather elaborate sexual blackmail operation designed to compromise politicians with child prostitutes. So then this is, again, today's news with Epstein. You know, this might explain that, why Epstein is an intelligence matter, supposedly. He belongs to intelligence, it was told. So, I mean, again, it's one of these things. And also, I think Cohen also tied into Thomas Dewey, too, who apparently was going after the mob, but he was only going after part of the mob because this was a part of the time to sort of lock things down, control things, take out the competition. This was the time when the what you saw in the 1960s was sort of what the traditional mafia, sort of the Italian mafia, sort of being brushed aside as the system became more corporatized. You saw that in Las Vegas in the 80s and 90s. And they don't, that era is over now. Now it's more corporatized. And now we have corporations. And we see that with General Dynamics being, you know, heavily invested by the Crown family, which was a mob family. But they go legit, like the Pritzker banking family made a lot of money off stolen property in California too.
That's right. And that's the thing, is that once you realize that, you know, criminality, particularly organized crime and the government are actually one, it's just one spectrum, right? You can see how easy it is to move back and forth between the two groups. Mm-hmm. There's no stigma upstairs. There's no stigma whatsoever. Roy Cohn is a good example. I mean, he was the consigliere to like fat Tony Salerno.
Yes.
And Galente, mm-hmm. You know, I mean, so these are just...
He's meeting with McCarthy and Bobby Kennedy.
Right. I mean, this is just incredible. I mean, he's actually... Because these guys are, you know, these are street murderers. Yes. You know, they're involved in, like, really, you know, gutter criminality.
They're taking baseball bats to people.
Yeah, yeah. This is when and he is their attorney for years to help them guide them through, you know, all of these problems. And at the same time, he's helping Trump's father get the real estate thing going. Then after they get out of like New York, you know, mob real estate, I think the first deal they did was Trump bought that land from little Nicky Scafaro.
Mm-hmm.
And supposedly it was like $1 million more than it was worth, but there was some kind of way that he was going to like get a kickback. I mean, the whole thing was just ridiculous. So, once the conspiracy theory, stigma is removed, it just becomes a lot easier to just see, you know. In fact, I would go so far to say is this: organized crime really couldn't exist unless it was part of the government. Has to be, because otherwise, because you can see so many elements of it are, if a competing force of organized crime tried to, you know, like a Sicilian focused mafia that wasn't under control of the secret society tried to set up a shop, it'd be wiped out. They'd be wiped out in a heartbeat. So what we have left is the organized crime that was developed by the secret society, by all of the so-called straight political people, who of course were using the money from the and the influence from the organized crime half or third of the component to get ahead with. So, you know,
another figure to look at to get an idea of how this works, the sort of the intersection of organized crime and sort of the legit world, political world, is Clark Clifford. He was this guy, Truman advisor. He was, official with the Truman administration. He wrote the National Security Act of 1947, the act that created the Central Intelligence Agency and created turned the War Department into the Department of Defense. So he's a big, you know, power attorney, banking. He got embroiled late years later in the BCCI scandal. When his bank, First American, claimed he didn't know that the bank was owned by BCCI.
Right, I remember this, yeah.
But BCI was collapsed because it was being utilized by gangsters, drug dealers, terrorist organizations, intelligence agencies to launder money, funnel money to pay for illegal arms purchases, pay for wars. This is how these banks used, almost like how the Banco Ambrosio was used by Roberto Calvi. In the Vatican Bank and these things. But what happened was, as the bank collapsed, it exposed his involvement in these things. And at the time, he was an octogenarian claiming he didn't know any better, and he died before they could attempt to prosecute him. But nevertheless, his connection to this thing illustrates what we're saying here, that it's all one big cesspool.
Yeah, and it's a system that has some way of, you know, of being organized, basically. I mean, again, it's a really good example is Freeway Ricky Ross. We talked mm-hmm. about, I mean, how he is being managed to damage culture through a criminal activity, how he is protected, developed. I mean, you have to have government sponsorship to have a really large organized crime, activity going on. There's no other way to do it, frankly. So when you see, when you see crack cocaine today, I mean, I am sure that there is some, it's not to say the government have hired the peddlers. It's that they're permitting it to go on. I mean, in other words, they have found now perhaps there's enough people who are developing the drug. They don't need to like promote it like they did originally. Yeah. So, but it's they permit it to go on with ineffective police activity, with the cultural destruction that makes people, want to use drugs like this in the first place, because it's all part of the cultural destruction.
Yeah, simply by making life suck.
Yeah,
I mean, that's drive people into exactly. drug use. I mean, it's like, you can create the macro effects that drive people to these things. So, what little money they do have, they either blow it on drugs or I don't know. Good example is, used to be something called the numbers racket. Now we call it the lottery.
Right.
And every day I'll walk into a convenience store and to get a cup of coffee, and I'll see some old guy there blowing $80, slowing the line down, buying lottery tickets.
I mean, it's tragic, but that's a great example of where they just dropped the veil of criminality and
They
suddenly it becomes
advertise,
popular.
you're winning money. Everyone's a winner. They show everyone winning big money and all that. And usually if you run into some of these people that won the lottery, $2 million here, within 6 months they're broke. Or maybe it's a year or two,
Yeah,
but
I mean they're yeah, because these are people who don't really know how to manage money and they just indulge destructive behavior, with and so the next thing you know they're broke and dead, and wow, that was a really fun experience. So I would just say that the way that the organizations between government and organized crime are set up are well explained by the P2 scandal. I think this is, you can really see the different components. You can see all of the, how broad it is, how masonry is basically the organizing, kind of the traffic cop of the whole thing, and how it reaches out everywhere. And then when you look at the ominous control over the largest newspaper in Italy by the Masons, then you can see, well, the public has no chance here. We're sitting ducks. So we have to break down the conspiracy theory stigma, which is really, I don't know about you, but man, I'm getting just more and more kind of energy directed against me that is coming from the idea of conspiracy theorists. And so I think this is actually a really good thing. And I actually hope it continues because if you really see them, trying ham-handed, like kind of propaganda techniques against conspiracy theorists, that means that they're hurting, or that there's some risk or danger that they see, right? Means we're starting to have some traction, because frankly, it is a conspiracy. And frankly, if you're not theorizing about it, your mind is turned off. So you have to do that.
Well, I mean, if you just read about the standard history of like construction of Las Vegas, there's all types of the intersection between mafioso figures, politicians, bankers, entertainment figures, and this extrapolate that from that's pretty much the country. I mean, Las Vegas itself is sort of a microcosm of the United States. You could look at Las Vegas as sort of, most people go to that place thinking it was an amusement park or a place to go to work. And they'll walk around taking the sights, the gaudiness of it all, perhaps, and not think about all the bodies that are buried. And
Have you ever
that's
been
that.
to Las Vegas, Tim?
No, I haven't.
I have. And I mean, talk about a cesspool. Man, oh man, it's beyond belief. I mean, it's boy, if Sodom and Gomorrah should be revisited, I think some of these
Yeah,
concepts,
I'm going
because
to sample one of the bankers. This is funny because it was Mormons using Catholic frontmen to finance Las Vegas because Mormons don't believe in gambling, but they'll finance it. But it was George Eccles, was a big banker out there that worked with Lansky and the various political figures out there to build Las Vegas. His brother, of course, was Mariner Eccles, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board in the 1930s. And so the chairman of the Federal Reserve's brother is working with characters like Moe Dalitz and Meyer Lansky to build Las Vegas so they can rip people off. Steal water, rip people off. Hey,
That's a great program. But I mean,
that's
so it's just the, and the public is given these stories about the greatness of our country. About how, we need more, you have to be set, you're prepared to sacrifice your life for freedom. It's just, you look at these kind of movies, war heroism
Yeah, we
movies.
want to bring off-track betting to Afghanistan.
Right.
And sodomy.
If only the public could open their eyes a little bit and see what really is occurring in terms of the financial, political, and media, that's that they understand that is actually their country, they would realize, man, you know, maybe I won't be willing to like sacrifice my life to defend it, because it is, you know, I mean, really, it's just this conspiracy by secret society. And it just manages our intellects. You know, it gives us our information. And when one of them is that we're a great country and this is freedom, and so we should be happy, you know, and willing to occasionally die for it.
No, they want to turn the country into like Cuba under Batista, where, you know, you get a few rich going as a playground, and the poor are stuck either, you know, working at menial jobs or selling their daughters off in the sex industry.
Yeah, and that's kind of what's happening now, except now with the, you know, I think they've got with the autism emergence, they're kind of like having designer slaves being created. Mm-hmm. With extremely low IQ, so that they're just perfect for the Delta and Epsilon of the Brave New World. And so this is what we're facing. And, you know, to not think that organized crime and the government are sort of related in this clear way. I mean, you know, the Kennedy assassination, you go back to these iconic events that the public hopefully will have some understanding of and maybe some emotional relationship.
Well, I know, come on. Jack Rubenstein, a.k.a. Jack Ruby.
Jack Ruby, yeah.
I mean, he ties into the Lansky operation, Carlos Marcello.
Yeah. Right. So the mafia is just swirling all around. Skull and Bones is just everywhere in terms of the whole process, bringing Kennedy there. And then you have the Warren Commission to like do the, basically to create a judgment for the public to accept. Well, it's just a closed loop of evil. Public never even gets a chance to come inside and say anything about it. So,
there's also, I think you'll like this, is we can't ignore MK Ultra and how brothels were used in MK Ultra, which were probably mafia owned.
That's a great point. Of course. Yeah, there it is. I mean, exactly that. And of course, you know, I mean, who was providing security for the original Acetus? The Hell's Angels.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so you've got basically this, you know, you have an MK Ultra project that is using prostitutes, right? And then so that's on one side of the mirror. On the other side are CIA operatives looking at the sex act with the drugged out John and the prostitute who's being paid by the government.
Yeah, that was Operation Midnight Climax. There was
Midnight Climax. I mean,
George Hunter White, I think, was the key figure.
Yeah, who ended up, you know, dead. But so the thing is, I think that's like a beautiful kind of encapsulated, kind of vignette where you can really see, you know, the Operation Midnight Climax. I mean, there is your government organized crime in action, right? Because the prostitutes are, I'm sure, all being run by, you know, by the mob, and the government is providing the drugs. The secret society has a purpose for this human experimentation, which is not revealed, right? We don't really understand why they're doing this, but it has to do with social control. And so that's the thing is that one thing I hope is that people will transition to not just think of money as being the goal of organized crime, because with Freeway Ricky Ross, it was more than money. It was a culture destruction and culture control. And the same thing is true with Operation Midnight Climax.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, from the standpoint of Freeway Ricky Ross, he was probably only cared about money. Same with Johnny Roselli, cared about, you know, betting, going to bed with beautiful women and money. But these are operatives.
Yeah, and I wouldn't be surprised even if people like Bugsy Siegel and some of the, you know, like Italian mob leaders that they have presented to the public. I wouldn't be surprised if they're completely legit in their main focus being just stealing money.
Yeah.
But that isn't the whole picture. It's the how they're being used, how they're being set up, and you have to have all of that to really, you know, get an understanding of the relationship.
Well, here's the example. It's just, we think of, again, I mentioned it earlier, but we think of figures like Johnny Roselli or Sam Giancana being, you know, bosses. But when it came down to it, when there was some heat being brought on you know, the system in the 70s with the Kennedy assassination, you know, I think he was shot in the mouth, Giancana, while he had an FBI bodyguard.
Right. That's
and,
right.
Of course, and Johnny Roselli's cut, stabbed to death and cut up in little pieces and thrown them into Miami Harbor. So there's something that obviously there, you know, there is a level above them.
Yeah.
They got rid of them.
That's another important thing is that, and also if you look at the P2 scandal, you can see the levels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
See the levels in operation. You know, like Roberto Calvi wasn't the top.
No.
He was swinging from the bridge there. You know, so this is the levels are another part of the conspiracy, which is another thing the public has to understand.
Well, I'm a good example. Why Italians and Jews at first were forming these scrapping it out in the early part of the 20th century and rising in the 20s and 30s with Prohibition. The establishment, the WASP establishment, had OSS and CIA.
Right.
Another criminal element, you know, like Rockefellers and these. But again, this also ties back, I think, going back to like the Rothschilds and these things. So it's hard to, you know.
Of course. I mean, it's the secret society is vast, right? And it is clear that there is all of these relationships. I mean, another way you can see criminality is the relationship between basically the Zionists from like the beginning of the 20th century and the British Freemasons that are promoting basically the creation of Israel, working with them,
yes.
Right? And there is a crime. The poor Palestinians are just going to be slaughtered. But then you have things like Churchill going to, forget the guy's name, but Saud, you know, the guy who ends up with Saudi Arabia, cutting a deal with him saying, look, we'll create your country, but you have to basically not complain about the partition of the what they call Palestine to the British protectorate. This won't be part of whatever you think your country is going to be. And they played all of the wasabis, they played it all against one another so they could end up with the kind of British protectorate they wanted. It was a complete crime.
And behind, of course, when we talk about the British Empire, we're really talking about Rothschild, right?
Well, I mean, the thing is, certainly they are behind, I've seen pictures of like Prince Charles and one of the Rothschilds at I think it was some kind of a meeting. And you can see that the Rothschild had become angry with Prince Charles and was pointing his finger right in his face. and Prince Charles was horrified. And you could really see the power structure there.
Yeah.
Who was like the alpha. But above the Rothschilds, I have no idea.
That's speculation. This is like
how that all works. But, I mean, we can just deal with this reality that we have. And the banking families are the top of the heap.
Yeah, I mean, here's an example. I mean, we can look at the tactics of an Al Capone or of one of the five families or of a Mo Dalitz or Bugsy Siegel or Joey Bats Arcoto out of Chicago and these very violent men, you know, when they're trying to stake out a territory or crush competition, like Joey Bats would take a bat to someone's head or something. Very violent bludgeon. But, you know, when a foreign leader or potentate or prime minister got in the way of the ambitions of United Fruit Company, like Guatemala, that they're able to pull off a coup.
Right.
Or Iran, right? Iran, yeah. For the interest of the Seven Sisters. And it's still geopolitical, but still gangster tax. It's just on a much higher level.
I mean, exactly. And that's the thing is that it's almost that you need to study organized crime so you understand your government.
Yeah, it really should be a part of political science.
In many cases, it's a little bit cruder and easier to follow, like the P2 event.
Well, that's how silly civics courses are.
Yeah.
As if you're going to embarrass these people into following the rules by saying, hey, wait a second, what about my constitution? You're supposed to do this. You know, no, it's a gangster operation. They don't, you know, they may gauge in, all types of, you know, sophomoric arguments, you know, come to justify, but at the end of the day, is it just a criminal operation?
Yeah, and the veneer of dignity and of respect for humanity, that's just, these are just tools to keep you mind slaves so that you don't rebel, so that you don't think about the conspiracy. That's all it is. Because in fact, there isn't anything. I mean, in fact, it's if you look at the human experimentation of involved in MK Ultra, how long standing and widespread it was, you can see, look, these guys could care less about human beings. They could care less. So organized crime, I mean, this is, you know, I mean, the spectrum has no point where there is a sharp defining, you know, line between the two. It's all part of the same thing.
Yeah, I was reading that. There's an excellent piece. This was got me thinking about it that I read by Ron Unz about his American Private series about California. And he cited the book, Chicago Outfit and Supermob, by Gus Russo. I read Supermob. I haven't read the Outfit yet about Chicago. But anyway, he's talking about how many of these characters, particularly this guy David Basilum, who became an appellate judge at age 40 to get away from an IRS investigation. The Truman administration did this for him. But when he was, once he became an appellate judge, he became a liberal crusader for civil liberties. And someone commented that it's funny how these people, you know, who pretty much stole all this property from the Japanese Americans, became radical civil libertarians.
Yeah. It's like seeing the Schiff family, you know, supporting the NAACP.
Yeah, yeah.
And just a second, like, wasn't it like 50 years ago you were financing the slave trade? What happened?
You know? What happened? Geez, is it your conscience now kicking in here?
Yeah.
The article speculated that a lot of these the advocates of civil liberties and liberal causes, is what they wanted to do was sort of create disorder in society, promote street crime, so people focus their attention on the street crime and sort of the disorder in society, so they wouldn't worry about this high-level chicanery and financial chicanery and corruption. Because if you look around the country, people are being stolen, robbed blind. Yeah. People no longer have any savings or heavily in debt, education. Yeah.
And look at the Godfather films and Goodfellas.
Yeah.
Look at those films, how distracting they are, you know, from the real criminality. They just create this whole little world you can collapse into, and like your mind just pays all its attention to, gee, there's this street crime, you know, where these guys walk around in fancy suits and like drop $20 bills and, you know, have these, you know, interesting little kind of maneuvers to control drugs and prostitution and things. Man, this is just a distraction. It's really the Goodfellas. The Goodfellas and the Mattachine, you know, that's the very lowest level of the criminality. Believe me, up above it is the high levels, you know, and it's Alan Dulles and the crimes at that level and controls at that level. I actually saw an interview with Alan Dulles where they were talking about, I believe it was MK Ultra. I'm not sure, but it was some, you know, very sketchy CIA. I think it was MK Ultra. And Dulles looked right into the camera and he said, "I just want the American people to know that the orders to carry out these programs came from the very highest level."
But he didn't elaborate, did he?
No, but I mean, it just made this obvious Masonic joke. I mean, you know, the highest levels ordered this. Well, yeah, they did. The problem is we don't get to see the level. Yeah. You know, Tim, I'm sick of it, man. I really want to, we have to get out of the street crime and let's get these the high level criminality stuff exposed, huh? I mean, this is what we should be looking at, not the Godfather, you know. It's the banking father that we need to have exposed and have a little, you know, have the public be more interested in that instead of like worrying about Goodfellas and, you know, this kind of stuff. That has nothing to do with the problems we're facing.
Mm-hmm.
The real problems.
Yeah. Okay, Joe, I think we covered it.
Yes, sir. I think we did. Well, Tim, pleasure.
Okay.
See you next week.
Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.